versus National Action Financial. Mr. Phillips, Mr. Schultz again.
Like Yogi Berra, deja vu all over again. Again, may it please the court, I'm David Phillips. I represent the class in Jackson versus NAFS, National Action Financial Services, and I represent the plaintiffs in Jackson versus Midland. The NAFS case was before Judge Castillo in the Northern District of Illinois, and the Midland case was in front of Chief Judge Holderman. And initially, both judges got it right. They denied motions to dismiss and said, have at it, prove up that it's false or prove up that it's deceptive or misleading. And what happened in between? Well, we did a lot of discovery to determine what actually the settlement parameters and guidelines were, and it was different in the two piles of cases. We also undertook to conduct the first two ever surveys. And were the surveys perfect? Absolutely not. You know, we had scant guidance. We were told to just do surveys.
Who conducted the survey?
A fellow named Howard Gordon from GFRI, which is a market survey fellow. He taught at Northwestern. He does market research and market surveys. He's the one who did both surveys for us.
Did he submit an expert's report?
Yes, he did. He submitted expert reports in both with opinion and all the survey questionnaires. And
well, the judge was particular, Judge Holderman, I guess, was particularly, maybe Judge Castillo, particularly disturbed, I think, by the ambiguity of limited time offer. Why weren't these people asked, if you read this, would you think that this was your last chance for this discount, or that it might be, you know, offered again, or what?
In hindsight, that would have been a good question to ask, Your Honor. But we did have kind of the belt and suspenders of the other survey. And you're right, it was Judge Holderman. In that case, we asked the same sort of survey, obviously using Midland's letters. And the penultimate question was, do you view this as a limited time offer? In the NAFS case, using their letters, somewhat similar, somewhat different, the penultimate question was, do you view this as a one-time offer? That was done deliberately to see, did those phrases make any difference in the magnitude of the results? And the magnitude was the same. Better than 80%, people said, I think it's a one-time offer. Better than 80%, I think it's a limited-time offer. Because, once again, you know, in the collection letter in the Goswami decision, which kind of sort of set off some of this settlement offer litigation, the Fifth Circuit's decision, the district courts that have tried to move heaven and earth not to follow Goswami and either decided on a 12B6 motion to dismiss or judgment on the pleadings have all focused on, well, the letter has to say, if I could quote this, this is from a concern raised by both Judge Castillo and Judge Holderman, who decided after Judge Castillo. They both say, and many other courts say, well, the letter has to say it's a one-time-only offer. Well, that's nowhere in the Goswami letter. There's language in there that the Fifth Circuit, three pretty sophisticated readers, interpreted to mean it's a one-time-only offer. And that's very similar language to what we have in the NAFS case, where there's a deadline, there's discussion about maybe we can extend the deadline. Well, the actual evidence...
Well, isn't the inclusion of the word only the difference between the Fifth Circuit and this case?
What the Fifth Circuit actually said is effective immediately and only during the next 30 days. Okay,
Only.
That's right. That's right. But I think that when you look at the language here, let's look at the NAFS letter. In order to take advantage of this offer, your payment must be received in our office on or before the date listed below. pretty similar. I mean, maybe you and I can parse that out and make a distinction, but I don't think unsophisticated consumers made that distinction.
So what is it you're proposing? What would these people? I think the most serious problem with your case is we certainly don't want to prevent the debt collectors from making offers, settlement offers.
Neither do I.
They're ridiculous and so on, but they should be permitted that. So what should they say in order to eliminate what you consider misleading?
Well, you could use a transitional phrase like, Your Honor, the panel you were on in Bartlett versus Heibel, where you wrote a safe harbor letter where you explained in a lawyer's collection letter where they threatened, we're going to boil you in oil, but if you dispute the validity of the debt, we'll stop boiling in your oil until that happens. You get transitional phrases in these settlement letters. You could say, "This is we want to hear from you by now." You know, that doesn't mean that we might not make you a different offer later on, but this is the offer on the table.
That's what disturbs me. If you say, 50% discount, take advantage of this and so on, but if you turn us down, we may offer you the same thing again.
Or we may never offer you another one.
But I mean that reduces all the... I mean, that's like going into a settlement negotiation and saying, I'm demanding $1 million, but if you don't want to pay $1 million, maybe I'll accept $1,000.
Sure. Right? Well, that's where if we sent you in, Judge Posner, to negotiate, let's call it a buying a car, okay? You probably get on the internet, do some research, prices.
I don't shop, actually.
Well, you might know somebody who'll shop for you, or your wife sends out the shop for you. But, Judge, based on your experience and your experience in business and teaching, that's probably not the final price there. Maybe I can wheel and deal. But if we go get your neighbor,
you
were asked to deliver the note to, who doesn't quite know that.
No, I'm not quarreling with your proposition that there may be people who are misled. What I'm troubled by is what form of words would eliminate the deception without simply making these settlement offers entirely meaningless.
Well,
would they have to say this is a final offer and we won't, and then they'd have to stick by it?
I think if it is in fact a final offer, but in these cases the authority...
So what should they say? This is not a final offer?
Well, no, I think they could say this is the offer that we're willing to make at this time. This doesn't mean that we'll extend it or that we won't extend it.
That's what bothers me. They're going to put in a sentence that says we may extend it or not extend it. What does a consumer do with that information? I think that's even more confusing than what you have here.
Or would it be language like this may be your only chance to settle?
Well, if it isn't... If it is in fact your only chance to settle, here...
But we may not offer you
Sure, we may not offer you
again.
We might not, but this is the offer on the table right now through this 30 days. And they are free to change the offer.
Would you accept this if they said, we are not obligated to continue or renew this offer after the following date?
I think that's acceptable, too. I think that would be. In this case, the evidence showed to the contrary, where, in fact, NAFS is almost identical, I argue, other than the one word only, but I think the time frames are the same for unsophisticated consumers. The factual evidence developed in the NAFS case was identical to Goswami. Goswami was a Capital One account, and they actually had a matrix. That you've seen the opinion that says if the debt is this amount and it's this many days past due, you can offer discount up to this. And if it goes, the discounts kept getting better the further out the debts went. And that was very similar here. When they made their offer of 75%, their actual authority was 50% at any time. And then when they made their second offer to settle for 50%, it was actually 40% at any time. When you get into the Midland pile of cases, the debt collector there, Midland Credit Management, is related to the what we call the scavenger creditor, colloquially. They call them debt buyers. It's the two different aisles. But they paid pennies on the dollar for the debt and could settle at any time for whatever they wanted. They really weren't limited by their creditor. They said, in effect, we don't go below the 50%. You know, the district court found the 50% because the actual amount changed a little bit by interest over time, that the 50% was never the same 50%. That was splitting hairs. I mean, what happened here, if I may finish.
Sure.
What happened here is the two district courts got it right. All the other district courts, you know, the tide turned and everything went negative, and they went negative. And I don't think they should have. I think the letters were false based on the evidence. And I think the two surveys, albeit not perfect, but as good as we could think up with our you know, reading the tea leaves, were pretty good. And the magnitude was good enough. If we were talking the difference between 1% confusion and 2% confusion, I could see the various quibbles that were picked could affect the outcome. But what are you talking here, really? When it's 80%, was it 50%? Was it 40% if everything was perfect? That's still a high level of confusion. Thank you very much.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Phillips. And Mr. Schultz, it's your turn. Your last at bat.
Hey, please, the court. Thank you. Actually, I think Judge Castillo got it right the first time. If you look at the record, when the case came before him the first time, he dismissed it. And then they filed an amended complaint. He said, well, okay, I'll let you go forward with the motion. I'll let you go forward with the survey. So, and I think all the other judges got it right the first time. Again, it's kind of important to point out that this case, too, has two halves. Is the letter false? In the first instance, is it false? So we're not looking at surveys on that question. And then, is the letter confusing or misleading? So again, I think we have to look at it that way. And we look at the record on the falsehood. What does it show? And they're trying to say it's false. Why are they trying to say it's false? They're trying to say it's false because you have authority to do something else.
I don't attach any weight to this distinction between false, deceptive, and misleading. The question is, are, you know, ordinary consumers likely to be confused by this into thinking that if they don't accept the settlement, you know, it's gone, it'll never come back. What about this idea? Why not just add a sentence which said, you know, we're not obligated to renew this offer after the date passes, something like that.
I think he'd still sue it, or somebody else would still sue over that. Because
it was okay, actually. If we say it's okay, then it's okay.
So the principle. Well, maybe he will, maybe he won't. I assume that's correct. But I think the principle of his case is, but because you haven't. There's two parts of his case. One, the deadline part, and that would deal with the date, the deadline, whatever you want to call it. The other part.
50% discount is a joke, right? Because in most of these cases, you'll be happy with, you know, cover the cost of postage.
I'd like to address that. That is absolutely not the case, Your Honor. That is absolutely not the case. It's a misconception about this industry that's being forced upon in this brief. It's not in the record. That is not in the record.
What is the average percentage debt collected by this industry?
I'm not sure I have that statistic, but I think the record here helps.
Yeah, you can't. You might as well drop this, right?
Well, I think because the record shows what happens here, and they don't do that. They absolutely do not do that. These are sophisticated business people with a big economic model.
Yeah, sophisticated business people buy this stuff cheap and collect a small quantity and make money. That's fine. No objection to that. If you have the statistics and you can tell us, yeah, they collect 50% of these debts.
I'll tell you that in the middle, the record before you in Midland is that. What does the record show? It shows that they will never, almost never, settle below 50% because that would kill them as a business. They recognize that, yes, if they're buying this stuff at that price, very competitive market, hundreds of billions of dollars of this stuff out there.
Well, now, wait a second. If they almost never settle below 50%, why don't they say this is our final offer? That's perfectly lawful. They can say that. If they don't want to say that, they can say, if it's true, only on a rare occasion will we renew this offer. They could say that if it's true, or they could say we're not obligated to remove. They can say any of those things.
Well, first of all, it's not true, and the record shows it's not true in connection with the Midland case because these debts
I don't care what's true or not true. You can, whatever you say is true, whatever is true, you can represent in your letter. Now, if it's true, that they rarely go below 50%, they can say we rarely renew our offer after the deadline. They can say that, right? What's wrong with that?
But there's a problem with it. With the
why is that a
dollar,
problem?
Because there's two distinctions. There's two theories here: the dollar amount and the date. And what happens is we don't know what's going to happen in the future. We don't know if they're going to continue this program or not continue this program.
They almost never go below 50%. You said that.
Right, but they start back right after this letter. They'll go back and they're seeking 100%. They're seeking the full value. That's the problem. Everyone testified to that. They're going to seek that. And if they start saying, we're at the 50%, we're at the 50%, they'll never get the full value of the thing. And they won't settle below 50% because that would kill their business model. They can't make money.
So why don't they say, this is the final offer. If you don't accept this offer, we're gonna go back and get it 100%.
Well, Mr. Phillips' theory though says that because they're negotiable, because they'll negotiate.
No, you just
amount.
Said they won't negotiate. Once you make up your mind, what is the fact? Is it the fact that they never, almost never, renegotiate? If that's true, they can say that. If it's not true, then this may be misleading, depending on the weight put on the survey.
The facts are that the record in both cases are very similar as to how they negotiate and how they handle these collection letters. They will send out, on occasion, settlement letters. On occasion, they will send out settlement letters. I think Ms. Steen testified that certain debtors might get some settlement letters some months, others might get some other months. Some debtors will never get some. That's the program. They have analyzed it, and they decide who's going to get them.
Fine.
Then after that date, they're obviously making phone calls, too. After that date, the offer is off the table. But they do have authority to negotiate. So what do? They start again. Pretty much everybody does this. They'll start again at 100%. Okay, but if somebody calls in, can they negotiate? Yes, there's usually parameters given them for negotiation. For instance, Midland's parameter said a collector on the phone, and they have hundreds of them, could... If she chooses to do so, could go down to a 40% discount. Recognize, though, that you're supposed to try to get the 100% and you're on a commission, so you should try to do that. Then what happens?
Start 100, go down 240 or buy 40? To 60
buy 40,
or 40?
I'm sorry. They could go down 10%, 20%, 30% left, okay. 40%. And then, and this is similar in NAFS, but I'll just use the Midland example. And then if they're going to go any further below, without a settlement letter being out there, without an offer being out there, if they're going to go any further, they got to go to the boss, one of the supervisors there. And it's a room not unlike this room, and there's a person, two people standing there, sitting there, they're the boss. Then the testimony is by everybody, and there's records on this, that you don't go below 50. There is maybe a few times a month you can go to the person in the other room behind them, the head of all these people.
Okay, now in what percentage of cases, if the person rejects the initial 50% offer, is he later offered 50%?
Well, I don't know that that was developed in any of the records.
Well, that's kind of critical.
I think that what is in the record is, and what you can see from in the middle, one, Ms. Ackman's letters are probably a good example.
But suppose it turns out that in 60% of the cases, the debtor ends up being done once again, or being offered eventually the 50% discount again. So that sounds like substantial, renegotiation. So then it would be false to say this is a final offer, take it or leave it,
Well, nobody says that.
It's accurate to say we're not obligated to renew the offer, right?
We're not obligated, right? But if that, then the evidence is going to show that they do renew the offer, and he'll get sued for making a confusing or misleading statement. Because
no, if you say we're not obligated to remove the offer, then we might say, look, that's your safe harbor. You put that in your Dunning letter, and you're safe, right?
If we are not obligated to renew the offer,
right.
Okay, but in this case, what they're suing on is that because you had authority to do negotiations, you can't be making a statement that would confuse them as to that.
That's why they. What's wrong with their argument? If it turns out now you don't like their survey. Their survey wasn't great. Mr. Phillips was pretty candid about that, but it's evidence. Why wouldn't this be a triable issue? They have survey evidence. You have some other evidence.
Well, I don't think it's false. And if the cases have made a distinction between false and confusing, misleading.
I don't know why they worry about that. It seems so pointless. The point is, you can read this and you can imagine yourself unsophisticated consumer, and you could say, oh, well, you know, I better do this by the deadline or I'm out. They're going to come and, you know, drive me into bankruptcy. You could do that. Now, that's not certain or anything, so he bolsters it with his survey. And the survey shows, weakly perhaps, but some evidence that some people think, yeah, this is a one-time offer. This is a great deal. If I don't take it, it's not going to come back.
Okay.
So why isn't that enough evidence to create, you know, an issue for a trial?
I can go into the nuances of the offer, but I'd like to say just because they viewed it as a one-time offer, that can be correct. What do you mean by one-time offer? What does it mean? It could mean that this was a one offer with this date.
The understanding of a one-time offer is that this is a deal. I better take this. This is, you know, because it's not coming back. If it's coming, if it's a continuing offer, it's going to be renewed. It's not a one-time offer.
But this is a one-time offer. You're going to get another offer maybe in the future. That doesn't preclude another offer in the future.
That's, you know, reading it literally and so on. But unsophisticated people, look, it's hard for us to brag about, right? Hard for us to think of ourselves as unsophisticated. I'm actually an unsophisticated consumer. But still, it's hard to imagine what it's like to be someone, you know, with no education and so forth. So why isn't a survey a useful way to, you know, survey the people who have average education or below average education, and if they're confused,
they won't confuse the judge. First of all, they won't even ask how they were confused or not. Nobody ever asked them that question. Were you confused? Nobody ever asked them, does this letter mean to you you're not going to get another offer? Does this letter mean to you you're not going to be able to negotiate it? They never asked any of those questions.
The evidence is so weak that it was inadmissible?
Yeah, absolutely. The questions were terrible, Judge. You read.
Did the judges rule that it was inadmissible?
Yes, Judge Castillo.
Or just
barred, and Judge Holderman disregarded it, not unlike what happened in the Sims case.
Discussed it. I don't know what you mean by disregarded it.
Judge Castillo granted our Daubert motion. It was not admissible.
Judge Holderman, what did he do?
He disregarded it.
He did not grant the motion on
the Daubert. He considered it unreliable, not useful. Disregarded it. I did not believe he would have allowed it to be submitted to the jury.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Schultz. And Mr. Phillips, your time has expired, so I think we'll... Okay, all right. Yeah, okay. Okay, that's fine. We'll give you an extra minute.
Your Honor, one of your specific questions was, what was the amount paid? What was the yield they expected? If you look at our brief, we have that in page 24, footnote 9. Midland Credit Management was paying approximately 3 cents on the dollar and hoped to yield within 54 months 8 to 9 cents on the dollar. That's what their hope for a yield was. The other issue was, you know, what kind of letters were people sent? They said that, they wanted 100%. The evidence in the Midland case is all these consumers were ever sent were 50% settlement offer letters. And the only controlling factor was, when I took the depositions of these people, did they have enough postage in their budget to send the person out a letter? That was the timing issue. They would go through their files and go, okay, we can send out to 100,000 consumers. We'll send out to 100,000 consumers. There's never a demand for full payment, ever. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much to both counsel, and the court will be in recess.